This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello, and welcome again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 38th episode. This month's edition is a special one as we are recording before a live audience here at Endo 2023. Today, we will look carefully at a recent paper from the JCENM that challenges how we screen individuals for primary aldosteronism. And in a minute, I'll introduce myself as the host, our regular contributor, and our guest expert. First, however, I will mention a special feature of today's podcast that recording here at Endo allows for. Four senior fellows join us to help analyze today's article. They each submitted questions in advance, and I will call on them throughout the episode to ask those questions. Though we outsourced a little of our work today, we will do our usual careful consideration of the methodology and how to apply the results for this article. I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop and work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, where I am a general endocrinologist, the medical director for our outpatient endocrinology clinics, and an associate director for our fellowship program. Our regular contributor today is Salila Kura. She comes to us from the Columbia University in New York City. She serves as the clinical chief of endocrinology there, as well as an assistant dean in their medical school. Importantly, for our purposes, her clinical focus is adrenal disease, and she is the medical director for the Adrenal Center at Columbia. Our guest expert today needs no introduction, though I will briefly give him one anyway. Bill Young is one of the world's experts in adrenal disease, working at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He has published extensively in this field, is a past president of the Endocrine Society, and is the editor-in-chief of JCENM Case Reports. I suspect he is best known to you listeners from his numerous talks that he has given on adrenal disease, which is one of the reasons we are delighted to have him join us today. So, as is invariably the case, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me today to discuss a paper on adrenal disease. Everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this episode of the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, we look at aldosterone, renin, and aldosterone to renin ratio variability in screening for primary aldosteronism. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this manuscript in January 2023 with Elizabeth Ng from Monash Health in Victoria, Australia as the first author. Now, I will hand things over to Salila. She will walk us through the author's introduction and the key points that they make. She and Bill will help lay the groundwork for understanding this paper by discussing some key concepts related to primary aldosteronism. Salila?
Thank you so much for inviting me here today. It's an honor to be here with you and with Bill. So we'll just get started and dive right into the paper. So this paper talks about primary aldosteronism, which is the most common secondary cause of hypertension. Plasma aldosterone to renin ratio is the recommended screening test for primary hyperaldosteronism, and interpreting the screening test, as we all know, can be challenging. An elevated ratio due to the normal elevated plasma aldosterone concentration relative to a low or suppressed renin activity or direct renin concentration is deemed a positive screening test, though there's a lack of uniformity in the assay preference and cutoff values as well. And we were hoping Dr. Young could give us a brief overview of the current guidelines and recommendations.
So the Endocrine Society guidelines on primary aldosteronism were last published in 2016. A guideline panel has been reconvened, and there will be an update to those guidelines probably coming out toward the end of 2024. So it's really early days in that evaluation. When we wrote those guidelines in 2016, we tried to highlight seven high-risk groups that we recommended have case detection testing for primary aldosteronism. They included patients with blood pressure is greater than 150 over 90 on repeated measurements. Resistant hypertension, which is three drugs, poor control, at least one drug is a diuretic, or good control on four or more drugs. Hypertension, hypokalemia, hypertension and an adrenal mass, hypertension and sleep apnea. And the last two groups, patients with hypertension and a family history of early onset hypertension or strokes at a young age, and lastly, hypertension and you have a first-degree relative that's been diagnosed with primary aldosteronism. So those were the subgroups that we focused on who should have case detection testing for PA.
Great, thank you. And discussing the aldosterone to renin ratio, the thresholds for positive screening range from 20 to 30, which we commonly use here in the United States, where we use the plasma renin activity for calculation, which is equivalent to the 70 to 100 when using the direct renin concentration. And it's important to remember those numbers as the cutoffs, since that's what's used in this paper. When using plasma aldo concentration and direct renin concentration, an ARR of greater than 55 has been proposed as a cutoff with optimal sensitivity and specificity. So Dr. Yang, I'm curious about your thoughts on that as well.
This is a very important publication because it took repeated measurements of aldosterone and renin in patients with hypertension, some of which had primary aldo, some did not. And the authors documented this remarkable variability in measurements of aldosterone and renin on different days. So this cutoff of 55 picomole, if you just use that, 28% of their patients with primary aldo would not have been detected. So I think this really highlights something that we actually have known about, and that is measuring aldo and renin is not a great case detection test. I still think it's the best test we have, but we all have to understand the caveats, and that's the focus of this article.
And previous studies have reported the high intra-individual variability in aldo and the ratio using the plasma renin activity as the denominator, with a substantial number of subjects with primary aldosteronism shown to have a ratio or an aldosterone concentration below the author's defined cutoff for the positive screen for primary aldosteronism, as Dr. Yang was just referring to. So using the plasma renin activity is now less commonly done in routine clinical pathology laboratories with the direct renin concentration favored for renin measurement. Data on the variability of the ratio with the direct renin concentration as a denominator is lacking. Accurate diagnosis of primary aldosteronism allows targeted treatment or potential cure with reduction in cardiovascular risk. And the initial screening test is therefore crucial in the identification of patients with possible hyperaldosteronism. And current guidelines are silent on the need to repeat the aldosterone to renin ratio if the initial result is negative or positive.
So at this point, we have our first fellow question coming up. So Seda Gregorian, who is currently a senior fellow at the University of Michigan, proposed, I thought, a really helpful question here, and she'll ask Bill that right now.
Hi, Dr. Yang. So my question is, in the event that the initial testing AAR is negative, do you think that there's value in repeating screening, or should we go to the confirmatory testing after that?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and that's what this article raises. So for me, as a clinician, it really depends on clinical context. For example, let's say it's a 75-year-old person with hypertension, well controlled on one drug, you measure aldosterone, you measure renin, and the ratio is normal. I'm probably not going to pursue that further, am I? Whereas if I got that same ratio in a patient who's on five drugs, poorly controlled, or if there's a history of hypokalemia, I'm going to hammer that case. I might not just repeat it once or twice. And I may even go straight to confirmatory testing in such a patient.
So this study examines the intra-individual variability in the plasma aldosterone concentration, the direct renin concentration, and the ratio in hypertensive patients with and without primary aldosteronism in the absence of interfering medications. And it evaluates the results in the context of previously advised thresholds for a positive screening test to ascertain the potential impact of relying on a single aldosterone to renin ratio measurement when screening for primary aldosteronism. And no hypotheses or aims were stated.
Good. Thanks, Salila and Bill, both for setting the stage here, for helping us understand why we need this information. And I've already got a hint already that this paper has provided a lot of data that's going to help us think about our practice moving forward. So now we're going to move into the methodology, and we do our usual really careful consideration of that, because that's going to help us understand the results here. So what we'll do, and this is where we normally start, is thinking about the study design. And I'll say to start with that this is probably the biggest area that I might disagree with what the authors did here, or at least how they describe what they did. So they describe their work as a retrospective cohort study. And how I would think about this more is actually more of a cross-sectional study. So unfortunately, it doesn't make a big difference here, but as a reminder, for cohort studies, a key component of a cohort study is that you have at least two groups, sometimes multiple groups, and they're split whether they have an exposure or not. And as we'll see here in this, an exposure can be a positive result of a test that you do. But what makes it a cohort study is at the time of that, whether that's prospective and you're following these patients in real time, or whether it's retrospective and you're going back to look at data, the key is that when you start that study, when you split those people into those groups, they don't have the outcome of interest. You then follow them along in some fashion to see who gets the outcome, who doesn't get the outcome, and then if it's different between those two groups. And that's the real component there, is following that over time. Cross-sectional studies, on the other hand, are when you get all of the information at once. This can be a little bit tricky because all of that at once may not actually be the exact same point in time. So this can make it hard to think about it, because sometimes it can be one test and then it's a few weeks and you get another test and maybe a few weeks and another test. But really, you're not waiting for an outcome to develop. It's a few weeks that it's taking to get all this information together. But those are considered cross-sectional approaches. And typically, as we'll look at here, when you're looking at studies that examine the diagnostic accuracy of different approaches, those are almost always cross-sectional studies. So I think that's probably a better way to think about it. But like I said before, fortunately for us, I think it has very little impact on the analysis. So for that reason, I'll move on that. So as we think about the patients that are in this population, so all patients were seen by the Endocrine Hypertensive Service at a tertiary hospital in Melbourne, and that was from May 2017 all the way up through July 2021. And I think this is important to note. The authors do a great job of talking about this. This is not a general population. So these are folks who were sent to a specialty, a well-renowned center for hypertension. So these are folks that are not your usual hypertensive folks. So I think it's going to be really important as we think about how to apply these results to know what population was looked at. And again, the authors do a great job of commenting on that. So how you got to this clinic, you had to be referred by your general practitioner or another specialist specifically for evaluation of hypertension. Okay, so a few words on the protocol. We're going to spend a little while here because there's some important information here. So about the aldosterone to renin ratio. So the final analysis that the authors propose here, that they show here, includes only those individuals who had at least two measurements. I'll just make a comment there. It was a little bit unclear if that was a standard approach, if everybody who came to this clinic was going to get multiple measurements and that's why they had all of these, or if it was only a subset of patients. So a little bit unclear about that. But if you were in the final analysis, you had at least two measurements there. And then finally, as a part of that measurement, the final analysis included only those who had that ratio measured off of interfering medications. And the authors do a good job of providing a list of what they consider those medications to be. So now at this point, we're going to have our second fellow question. So Noor Suleiman, who's a senior fellow at the University of Virginia, had a great question here that he would like to propose for Bill.
Yes, my question, Dr. Young, it is necessary to exclude the non-mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, and what impact would that have on implementing these study results to patients for whom we cannot safely withdraw medications?
Yeah, thank you. That's a wonderful question. So, and this is a bit of a sobering fact in that these patients in this study were prepared ideally to measure aldosterone and renin. To be honest, that's not what I do in the clinic every day. I see patients like you asked about who are on 5 or 6 antihypertensive drugs and they're not well controlled. And I've seen clinicians say, oh, I can't test for primary aldosteronism because they're on 5 drugs, ACE inhibitor, ARB, loop diuretics, and I can't test. And I don't think that should be the message. I think we should be very aggressive in testing for primary aldo, but understand all the caveats, how the drugs may interfere. The way I use that information, if renin is suppressed in a patient on an ACE inhibitor, ARB, diuretic, something's wrong, right? They have PA. So I find it helpful when the patient's on an ACE inhibitor, for example. And I'll say the same thing if the patient's on a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist. If renin is suppressed, that's important information. But again, coming back to this article, these patients were prepared ideally, and look how poorly the aldosterone-renin ratio performed if you just measured it once.
Good. So important things for us to keep in mind as we're already thinking about how we can apply these results to the patients that we see. All right. So a few more words on that protocol. So the saline suppression, it was performed in a couple of different situations. So one that fairly standard. So if that ratio is 70, and again, that's the units that Salila mentioned before. So that was the fairly accepted positive case detection cutoff there. But also if it was less than 70 and there was a high clinical suspicion. So it sounds like what the authors did here was exactly what Bill describes that he does in his practice, is when you have a really high index of suspicion, you may end up moving on to that saline suppression testing anyway. So I think, again, something that we've got to think about as we consider how could we apply these to folks who are general endocrinologists like myself and maybe aren't quite as good at sniffing out who these folks may be. So we're going to keep that in mind. A few more words on the protocol. So for diagnosis, you were diagnosed with PA. If the aldosterone after that saline was a couple different cutoffs they used, they changed their protocol as the time went on. So if you were seated, then it had to be above 170. But if you were recumbent, then it was 140. And then if you moved on to having an AVS afterwards, they classified you fairly standard approach that they used there. If it was a unilateral disease or bilateral disease, they did have an indeterminate category, and there were a couple of ways that you could get into that. So if there were inconclusive results, and then they followed the standard criteria for that, but also if the patient elected to not undergo AVS and said, I'm not going to do surgery anyway, doesn't matter, and they were treated empirically medically, then in that situation, you also got lumped into that determinant category. Okay, a few final words. The data, I mentioned this before, this is retrospective, so this was all extracted from the EHR. And then a couple of comments on both the laboratory and statistical analysis. There was a single type of immunoassay that was used. We're going to come back to this in the discussion because it's an important point, so hang tight on that. And then there were several subgroup analyses that were planned by the authors early on. So they obviously wanted to look at the individuals who did and did not have PA. They wanted to look at the subtypes of PA. They wanted to look if there was a difference based on male versus female. There was a difference based on age, based on the severity of the hypertension, whether or not you had hypokalemia, and whether or not you had renal impairment. So Salila is going to walk us through these results. We'll get to those subgroups. And so we'll think about that then after she goes through those results, and we'll try to put this together and figure out what we need to do with this information.
Great. Thank you. So we'll go through some of the discussion points. So we'll start with review of table one. So it's the typical table one of patient characteristics. And of the 223 patients analyzed, PA was confirmed in 162 patients, so of which 51% were female, and excluded in 61 patients, of which 66% were female. The PA group displayed higher systolic and diastolic blood pressure compared to the non-PA group, with lower intra-individual average potassium levels and similar renal function. The median of the intra-individual average aldo-to-renin ratio was higher in the group with PA compared to the group without PA. It was 133 versus 37 picomol, with a higher median plasma aldosterone concentration, again, 451 versus 344 picomol, both with significant p-values, and a lower median direct renin concentration. And this is demonstrated graphically in figure one. So moving on to table two, notable points from table two was there was significant intra-individual variability in the sample coefficient of variation, the CV, of the aldosterone, the direct renin concentration, and the ratio in both the groups with and without PA, but no statistically significant difference between the two groups. The sample CV for Aldo differed significantly across PA subgroups, with the highest variability in the bilateral group, but there was no statistically significant difference noted across subgroups in the sample CV for direct renin concentration or the ratio. So the CV for aldosterone in unilateral and indeterminate groups were significantly lower than in the bilateral groups, with the p-value of 0.04 and 0.021 respectively, while the CV for aldosterone for unilateral and indeterminate groups were comparable, with the p-value of 0.554. Comparing the group with hypokalemia to those without hypokalemia, the sample CV for ALDO and direct renin concentration were significantly higher in the group with hypokalemia. However, no statistically significant differences were observed in the sample CV for the ALDO to renin ratio. The sample CV for ALDO direct renin concentration and the ratio showed no significant difference with gender, age, degree of hypertension, or renal function. So moving on to notable points from table three, similar to the sample CV, the percent difference, or the PD, showed large intra-individual variability. The median PD for aldosterone was higher in patients with PA compared to those without PA, 46 versus 38%. The median PD for the direct renin concentration and the ratio were larger than that for ALDO, but similar between the two groups. In the group of patients who had a direct renin concentration of less than 8, which is an undetectable renin when using plasma renin activity, the initial ratio measurement, the median CV for ALDO was 21% in the PA group and 25% in the non-PA group. The PD estimates were comparable across the primary aldosterone subtypes. The PD for aldosterone decreased significantly with age, while the PD for direct renin concentration and the ratio did not differ significantly between age groups. So of the 162 patients with PA, 62 patients or 38% had at least one ratio less than 70 picomole during the screening process. An initial ratio was less than 70 in 24 patients or 14.8% with PA, with three having unilateral PA. The initial ratio in this group ranged from 15 to 67 picomole, but were repeated due to clinical suspicion based on young age, previous hypokalemia, lack of other risk factors for hypertension, or resistant hypertension. Among the 61 patients without PA, 28 or 46% had at least one ratio greater than 70 picomole. One third of patients with PA, so 54 of the 162, had at least one aldosterone less than 270 picomole per liter, which is equivalent to 10 nanograms per deciliter. And 67%, so 109 of the 162, had at least one aldosterone less than 416 picomole per liter, which is 15 nanograms per deciliter in the units that we commonly use here. An aldosterone concentration greater than 277 picomole was satisfied on at least one occasion and not on other occasions in 29% or 47 of the 162 patients with PA, 8 with unilateral and 23 with bilateral. And the same inconsistency was seen in relation to a PA cutoff of greater than 416 in 48% of patients. This was 78 of the 162, with 15 having unilateral and 37 having bilateral PA. So a plot of sensitivity against specificity for the aldosterone to renin ratio cutoff suggested the following, that a ratio of greater than 150 picomole could reliably predict PA, while a ratio of less than 50, and in particular less than 20 picomole, could identify those without PA. And these points are illustrated in table four. An initial ratio of greater than 150 was seen in 66 people, 61 of whom had PA, giving this cutoff a specificity and positive predictive value of 92% for a PA. A higher threshold of ratio of greater than 200 was seen in 43 individuals, of whom 41 had PA. Thus, this ratio cutoff had a specificity of 97% and a positive predictive value of 95% for the diagnosis of PA. Looking at the use of lower ratio cutoffs for the exclusion of PA, PA was excluded in 41 of the 53 patients with a ratio of less than 50, that was a positive predictive value of 88% and a negative predictive value of 77%. And 16 of the 17 patients with a ratio of less than 20 picomole, and that was a positive predictive value of 78% and a negative predictive value of 94%.
All right, so Salila had the unenviable task of going through all of that data. So now we've got to figure out what to do with that. So where we'll start, where we normally do, is where the author starts. So with their main finding. So the main point that the authors want to start off with is that there is significant intra-individual variability in the PAC and the DRC in all patients. so that a third of patients with primary aldosteronism had at least one ratio that was below that positive threshold. So a couple of comments that they make then about the aldosterone concentration itself is that it is influenced by many factors, as we know, and that it varied in this study. And that was despite controlling several things that are known to affect that. So it was a similar outpatient setting. It was a similar time of day. They did not sedate patients. There was no postural variability, and they were off of all of those interfering medications that we talked about earlier. So that was with those things controlled for. Now we're going to get back to the question that we thought about before. Another fellow question for us here about the difference between immunoassay here and other ways of measuring this. So George Stamatiades, who is a senior fellow at the Brigham, is going to help us out here. He proposed a great question that he is going to ask Bill now about that.
Hi, Dr. Young. My question is, what are your thoughts on authors' conclusion of the potential impact among the two different assays, the immunoassay and the mass spec?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to be honest, I don't know the answer. I have a sense about it. We've been using tandem mass spec at Mayo Clinic for 8 or 10 years now. And my sense is we don't see this degree of variability. We do, though. We see patients who have PA, who have aldosterone levels below our cutoff. It happens, no question about it. But this nice article from Monash is going to trigger us to go back and look at our experience with the tandem mass spec assay in a similar way.
All right, so a couple comments about the cutoffs that are used. So Leela went through these, but these are really important. The authors hit them again, so we're going to as well. So they point out again that if you had used that that cutoff, that aldosterone cutoff of 277, which that's the 10 nanograms per deciliter, that a third of patients would have been missed. A third of patients with primary aldosteronism would have been missed if that was used just on a single test. And two-thirds of patients would have been missed if you had a higher cutoff, so the 416, or which translates to that 15 nanograms per deciliter. So significant numbers of people. So as we continue on, a couple of comments that the authors made about the renin concentration. So there's also a lot of variability there. That was potentially related to volume status and salt intake. So last fellow question that we have here. So Myung-Kyung Choi from the University of California, San Francisco has a question about that. So MK, why don't you propose your question for Bill?
Hello, Dr. Young. My question is, do you have any practical tips from your personal approach in trying to standardize the volume status and salt intake of the patients, at least during the time when they're getting these labs drawn?
Thank you. So the question is, do we have a protocol to standardize volume status and sodium intake when we're doing our testing for primary aldosteronism? Well, I mean, that could be one conclusion from this article, but that would be a bit of a throwback to what Jerome Kahn did. He described his first patient in 1954, was published in 1955, and he did fantastic work on describing the syndrome. But his protocol was 2 weeks, sodium balance, volume balance conditions, medication-free before doing any testing. And it helped him to, you know, describe this syndrome in full detail. But in real life, yeah, we simply don't do that. And one of the reasons is to do that, that's a barrier, isn't it? I mean, who here is going to do that if you're going to test for PA? Put your patient on a volume sodium balance situation for a couple of weeks before testing. No. And our problem right now in the United States, anyway, is clinicians do not test for primary aldosteronism. So there, remember at the beginning, I said the Endocrine Society came out with those high-risk subgroups. So at least 20% of people with resistant hypertension have primary aldo. At least 20%. At Stanford, they did a study looking at their chronic care network, and they had, I think, 4,600 patients with resistant hypertension, but only 2.1% were screened for primary aldosteronism. That's terrible. Now, the last thing I'd like to come out of this article are barriers for clinicians. We kind of need to do the opposite, right? We need to be encouraging clinicians to screen for PA because patients with PA have increased cardiovascular risk, decreased quality of life, increased CKD, all of which we can be preventing if we diagnose these patients earlier.
And barriers is a really important theme here. So we're going to come back to that. So we'll table that for now, but we're going to continue thinking about that here as we wrap up in just a few minutes. So the, even though the emphasis here, the main findings of this are the inconsistent findings, the authors do point out, well, there are some consistent findings from this study. And that was looking at the extreme. So if your ratio was very low, so less than 20, you were highly unlikely to have PA. And then on the other side, if your ratio was incredibly high, if it was greater than 150, then you were very likely to have primary aldosteronism. To move on to the author's limitations, I'll make an editorial comment that often limitation sections are their pro forma. People throw them in. It doesn't seem like maybe people are thinking about them very closely. This was one of my favorite parts of this. The authors did a really good job on the limitation section. So it's maybe an odd section to call that out, but I really thought they were very thoughtful about that. So they pointed out some things we've talked about already. This was a retrospective study. One important thing they said, there's likely a serious referral bias here. Because the way that we do things, and that's worldwide, is that there's usually a single test. And so if there's a lot of folks out there who probably had primary aldo and they're one of those groups that had a normal test initially, they probably did not get referred to this center in the first place. We don't know that for sure, but highly likely that that happened. So again, that's how we have to think about, well, what population was actually studied? It was not the general population. That's definitely going to be a big chunk of people who were missed there. Another thing that I really like is the authors gave some context about what they have been doing in their area. So they have spent extensive time educating local primary care providers about hypertension, in particular about primary aldosteronism. And so they think it is very likely that that affected referral patterns, and actually that there probably were folks who had relatively mild hypertension that maybe wouldn't normally have ended up at a referral center, maybe didn't meet the criteria that Bill outlined earlier. But because the primary care providers are particularly attuned to it, that may be lower that threshold in their mind, and they were picking up milder cases of hypertension. They point out things that we talked about already, that even though they controlled for a lot of things, there were a few factors that were not controlled. Acute stress would be one example, dietary sodium we talked about as well. And they did point out that multiple labs were used, even though the same lab assay was used, that was drawn at multiple places, so potentially some variability there. Okay, so now where I'm going to leave us is what the authors conclude. And I think their first conclusion, their main conclusion, is one that we would all see coming, is that this aldosterone to renin ratio should be repeated 2 or 3 times to confirm that somebody does or does not meet criteria to move on. But then they had a comment afterwards that was a little bit surprising to me, and I'll quote it here, that they say that decisions based on a single result may lead to unnecessary confirmatory testing. So I think that's going to challenge in how we think about applying these results and thinking about those concerns. So in a second, we're going to get to that. We're going to think about, should this change our practice? Should we be doing things different than what we're doing right now? Should the guidelines that are coming up, hopefully end of next year, should those be different? But where I want us to start with is just thinking about the quality of this report overall. Salila, let's start with you. As you analyze this, what was your impression of just the quality of this paper that was put together by these folks?
Yes, I was impressed with the quality of the study, and I do think it will change my practice in the sense that using this lower cutoff and this higher cutoff to not retest patients, which is actually sounds counterintuitive to the idea of testing people 2 or 3 times. But I think in patients where the diagnosis is more clear because of the sensitivity and specificity of these low and high cutoffs, that would change my management. And then as Bill was speaking about before, I think clinically, I've often stopped at 2 measurements, even when my suspicion is high, but maybe this would lead me to have more measurements if a patient comes in on 5 antihypertensives and is hypokalemic and otherwise really appears to have PA.
All right. And then Bill, I'll get your thoughts in a second here. I'll ask you some particular questions about how this might change our practice, but just your sense of quality of the report overall.
Yeah. So I like this article a lot. Every time I read a paper, I try to pick out one figure that I'm going to keep in my head. And when you do get to read this article, figure one is fantastic. Edward Tufte wrote a book on graphical excellence, which is something anyone writing manuscripts should look at and think about, because these are the main messages of your work. And people can carry away a graphic like this better than many other cutoffs and numbers. But what it is, it's showing each ARR multiple times in every patient, and it's color-coded based on whether patients had unilateral adrenal disease or bilateral adrenal disease. And it shows this incredible overlap with those that don't have primary aldosteronism. So it really drives the message home. So that's my favorite figure.
Good. And I agree. There was a reason that Salila and I went with this article to record our podcast here at Endo 23. It was very obvious that this was a high quality report and something that is a high likelihood of changing our practice. So we will stay there. So Bill, I want to wrap up with you here. So a couple different things that we need to think about. You're going to be wrestling with these questions and as will everybody who's writing these guidelines. But so do we need to be advocating for multiple ratios? Should that be standard or is that going to be a problem? You mentioned barriers already. We already don't test for this. That's true for probably everybody. Certainly primary care providers, probably also general endocrinologists like myself don't think about this enough. So if we make it even harder to do, are we going to do better or do worse? Or are people just going to say three times, I can't do that. Never mind. They're doing okay. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. So we'll start with that follow-up question. But what are your thoughts? Should we be trying to make this a standard practice?
Yeah, Chase, that's really the key question, isn't it? In other words, if we make this so hard to do, that resistant hypertension experience where only 2.5% are being tested is not going to get better. So we need to make it easier to do. I'd rather have a patient get one ARR and have it be falsely normal or falsely abnormal than not get tested at all. So testing is progress. But I think the main message from this article, if the clinical predictors don't fit with the labs you get, please retest. What do I mean by that? So the patient has hypertension, unexplained hypokalemia, but the aldosterone level is not high, or renin is a little bit above suppressed. Don't quit. You need to pursue that case, or the patient who's on five drugs with poor control. So, I mean, there's many examples where I personally do repeat aldo and renin measurements. I have a low threshold in such cases to do confirmatory testing.
Good. So then help us understand. So in the very end of the discussion, the authors raise this concern about, well, if we do multiple, we may end up with potentially unnecessary confirmatory testing. So, and I think this is particularly going to be in this situation where you have conflicting results. So you've already given us a situation, you have a very high index of suspicion. So that's going to be a subset. But what about these other ones to where you're maybe not quite so concerned, you've got conflicting results. Based on this, do you have any sense of what we need to do with that?
I still come down on the side that these patients have so much to gain. They have poor quality of life. They're at 3 to 4-fold increased risk for cardiovascular events, CKD. I think confirmatory testing is not that bridge that's too far. At Mayo Clinic, our confirmatory testing is a little bit different than what the Monash group used in this article. We do a 24-hour urine for aldosterone on a generous sodium diet. And at least in the Midwest, where we are right now in Chicago, I can confirm for you that many people are on a high sodium diet every day, right? So it's just a matter of taking a dietary history. And if they're on their high sodium diet, fantastic. You go ahead and do your 24-hour urine. You don't tell them to do anything different. You measure aldosterone, sodium, and creatinine. And if the 24-hour urine sodium is over 200 milliequivalents, and if their aldosterone in the urine is elevated, you have a positive confirmatory test, and you're not putting them through that saline suppression test.
And with that, I would like to thank Salila Kura, Bill Young, and our four fellows for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.